Hey everybody, it's Megan here with M. Beckelheimer Book Reviews. Here's my co-host, my wonderful husband, Josh.
Hello, I thought you were about to say cousin. Never mind.
We're not cousins. Both of our families are from West Virginia, but we are not cousins.
No, we're not.
Anyway, putting that aside, tonight we are talking about the collected poems of Sylvia Plath. It does not contain all of her work, but it contains a vast majority of it. Now, I have always been a huge fan of Plath's, but it's a little disturbing to see some of the parallels between our lives, so I hope my fate is not the same as hers.
I mean, if it is, I will try to make bank off of your death.
Just like Ted Hughes did to her?
Yes.
All right, good times. Well, as usual, we'll go with the author bio. I have a lot of information on her because, again, I'm a big fan, so. Anyway, she was born on October 27th, 1932, and she died on February 11th, 1963. She was 30 years old when she died.
Crazy.
She was an American poet, novelist, and short story writer. She is credited with advancing the genre of confessional poetry, which is my style of writing, so she's definitely a heavy influence of mine. She is best known for two of her published collections, The Colossus and Other Poems, as well as Ariel. And she's also known for her novel, The Bell Jar, which is semi-autobiographical, and it was published shortly before her death. In 1982, she won a posthumous Pulitzer Prize for the collected poems, which is what we're talking about tonight.
Okay.
She was born in Boston. She studied at Smith College in Massachusetts, and then she studied at Newnham College in Cambridge, England. She married fellow poet Ted Hughes in 1956, and they lived together in the United States and then in England. They had two children before they separated in 1962. She was clinically depressed for most of her adult life. She was treated multiple times with electroconvulsive therapy, which is also called ECT. And she died by suicide in 1963. But to rewind it back and talk about her early life, as early as 8 years old, she had published her first poem in Boston Herald's children's section. Over the next few years, she published multiple poems in regional magazines and newspapers, and at age 11, she began keeping a journal. She showed early promise also as an artist, and she won awards for her paintings from the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards in 1947. She also, her IQ was around, her IQ was around 160, so she was very intelligent. She attended Bradford Senior High School in Wellesley. She graduated from there in 1950, and just after she graduated, she had her first national publication in the Christian Science Monitor. After high school, she went on to attend Smith College, where she excelled academically. While she was in attendance there, she edited the Smith Review. And then after her third year of college, she was awarded a very coveted position as a guest editor at Mademoiselle magazine. So she spent a month in New York City. And that experience, if you've read The Bell Jar, that is what that experience is based on. It wasn't what she wanted it to be. It wasn't what she had hoped it would be. And so many of the events that took place that summer are used as inspiration in that novel. So a lot of it really did happen. She was extremely angry at not being able to meet the editor that had been arranged with her, which was the Welsh poet Dylan Thomas, who she was absolutely obsessed with, and more than life itself is the quote that I read, how much she loved Dylan Thomas. She hung around his hotel and everything for days, just hoping to meet him, but he was already on his way home. So then, a few weeks later, she slashed her legs to see if she had enough courage to kill herself. And then, during that time, she was refused admission to the Harvard Writing Seminar. So, anyway, after her ECT treatment for depression, she made her first medically documented suicide attempt. And that was on August 24th, 1953. She crawled under her house and took her mother's sleeping pills. She survived barely. I think she was down there for 3 days or something. I could have that fact wrong, but I think it was something like 3 days. And they couldn't find her anywhere. They finally found her. But she later wrote that she, and this is a quote, blissfully succumbed to the whirling blackness that I honestly believed was eternal oblivion. So she spent the next 6 months in psychiatric care. She received more ECT treatment and also insulin shock treatment. She made a pretty good recovery, and they let her go back to college. So, in January 1955, she submitted her thesis, which was called The Magic Mirror, a study of the double in two of Dostoevsky's novels. And then she graduated in June from Smith with the highest honors. She obtained the Fulbright Scholarship to study at Newnham College, which is at Cambridge in England. And that's where she continued actively writing poetry and publishing her work in the student newspaper, which is called Varsity, or was called Varsity. I'm not sure if it still exists. But that's where she met Ted Hughes on February 25th, 1956. In a 1961 BBC interview, which you can find in the British Library Sound Archive, she describes how she met Ted Hughes, and this is a direct quote from her. She said, "I'd read some of Ted's poems in this magazine, and I was very impressed, and I wanted to meet him. I went to this little celebration, and that's actually where we met. Then we saw a great deal of each other. Ted came back to Cambridge, and suddenly we found ourselves getting married a few months later. We kept writing poems to each other. Then it just grew out of that, I guess. A feeling that we were both were writing so much and having such a fine time doing it, we decided that this should keep going. That this should keep on." She described Ted Hughes as a singer, a storyteller, a lion, and a world wanderer with a voice like the thunder of God.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
She was clearly very much in love with him, for sure. So they were married on June 16th, 1956 at St. George the Martyr in London. And then she returned back to Newnham in October and began her second year. And then in June 1957, Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath moved to the United States. And starting in September, Sylvia Plath taught at Smith College, which, if you remember, that's where she went to college. But she found it very difficult to both teach and write. She just didn't have the energy to do both, which is understandable.
Yeah.
As a writer myself, I find it hard to find the balance. When I get home from work, the last thing I want to do is write, even though that's my passion.
I know what you mean.
So, anyway, in the middle of 1958, the couple moved to Boston, and then she took a job as a receptionist in the psychiatric unit of Massachusetts General Hospital, and then in the evening, she sat in on creative writing seminars. And during this time, she began to consider herself as a more serious, focused poet and short story writer. But she ended up resuming psychoanalytic treatment in December. She was very, very self-conscious about writing confessionally. She didn't want to use her personal and private material, even though she had multiple people encouraging her to do so, not just her husband, but other writers, because they were seeing how talented she was when she pulled from that source, I guess. So anyway, the couple ended up moving back to England in December 1959, and they lived in London. Their daughter Frida was born on April 1st, 1960, and then in October, Sylvia Plath published her first collection of poetry, The Colossus. In February 1961, Plath's second pregnancy ended in miscarriage. She's written several poems about this. The primary one that I want to talk about is Parliament Hill Fields. And I wanted to read this poem because it's really personal to me. I hope I'm not violating any copyright laws, but I'm going to read it. We're just going to go for it.
Yeah.
All right, again, it's called Parliament Hill Fields. On this bald hill, the new year hones its edge. Faceless and pale as China, the round sky goes on minding its business. Your absence is inconspicuous. Nobody can tell what I lack. Gulls have threaded the river's mud bed back to this crest of grass. Inland, they argue, settling and stirring like blown paper or the hands of an invalid. The wan sun manages to strike such tin glints from the linked ponds that my eyes wince and brim. The city melts like sugar. A crocodile of small girls nodding and stopping, ill-assorted, in blue uniforms, opens to swallow me. I'm a stone, a stick. One child drops a carrette of pink plastic. None of them seem to notice. Their shrill, gravelly gossips funneled off. Now silence after silence offers itself. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I just need a second. The wind stops my breath like a bandage. Southward, over Kentish Town, an ashen smudge swaddles roof and tree. It could be a snowfield or a cloud bank. I suppose it's pointless to think of you at all. Already your doll grip lets go. The tumulus, even at noon, guards its black shadow. You know me less constant. Ghost of a leaf, ghost of a bird. I circle the writhen trees. I am too happy. These faithful dark-boughed cypresses brood, rooted in their heaped losses. Your cry fades like the cry of a gnat. I lose sight of you on your blind journey. While the heath grass glitters and the spindling rivulets unpool and spin themselves, my mind runs with them, pulling in hill prints, fumbling pebble and stem. The day empties its images like a cup of a room. The moon's crook whitens, thin as the skin seeming a scar. Now, on the nursery wall, the blue night plants, the little pale blue hill, your sister's birthday picture starts to glow. The orange pond ponds, the Egyptian papyrus light up. Each rabbit-eared blue shrub behind the glass exhales an indigo nimbus, a sort of cellophane bloom. The old dregs. The old difficulties take me to wife. Gulls stiffen to their chill vigil in the drafty half-light. I enter the lit house. Sorry, that was a little tough for me to read, so I'm sorry I stumbled a little. I was trying. Anyway, moving on. In a letter to her therapist, Sylvia Plath wrote that Ted Hughes beat her 2 days before the miscarriage. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but it likely did, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, I've now lost my place because I'm so discombobulated after reading that poem. Anyway, okay. In August, she finished her novel, The Bell Jar, and immediately after that, the family moved to a small market town in Devon. And then Nicholas, their son, was born in January 1962. In 1961, the couple rented their flat to another couple. Ted Hughes was immediately struck with the beautiful woman in that couple, and she returned those affections. In June 1962, Plath had a car accident, which she described later as one of many suicide attempts. And then and in July 1962, she discovered that her husband had been having an affair with the woman that they had rented their flat to. And then in September, they separated. Meaning Sylvia and Ted separated. So beginning in October of that year, she experienced a great burst of creativity and wrote most of the poems on which her reputation now rests. She wrote at least 26 of the poems of her posthumous collection of Ariel, which is arguably one of the greatest American poetry books ever written. If you've never read it cover to cover, you should. It's just incredible. She wrote that during the final months of her life. And then in December of that year, she returned back to London with her children. That winter was one of the coldest winters on record. It was actually the coldest in 100 years. The pipes froze, and the children, Frida was 2, and Nicholas was 9 months old. They were sick all the time. It was so cold, and they didn't have a telephone in the house. And her depression got really bad again, but she completed the rest of her poetry, and which was published shortly after she died. And her only novel, The Bell Jar, which we've talked about quite a bit here, it was published in January 1963 under a pen name of Victoria Lucas. You'll now find it under her actual name, but back then it was under Victoria Lucas. And I think that she did that because she... If I remember correctly, she didn't want to embarrass her mother or something like that. But it was met with critical indifference, which is interesting because now it's considered to be one of the greatest novels ever. So, at the time, it wasn't received well. So, she, in January 63, she spoke with her general practitioner. And he was also a close friend, and he lived nearby. And she described to him how depressed she was, and how long it had been going on. And she for most of that time had been able to continue to work, but her depression just kept getting worse and worse. And she just couldn't. She was just very agitated, and she had suicidal thoughts, and she could not cope with her daily life. She was a notorious insomniac. She had to heavily medicate herself to go to sleep. This is scaring me. And then she would wake up really early. She ended up losing like 20 pounds, and but she took care of her appearance. She never outwardly spoke of feeling guilty or unworthy or anything like that. She didn't advertise it, I guess is the way to say it. But this doctor friend of hers, he prescribed her an antidepressant a few days before suicide. But he knew that she was at risk and that she had two small kids. So what he said is that he visited her daily, and he worked really hard to have her admitted to a hospital, but it wasn't happening. So what he did was he arranged for a live-in nurse. So the nurse was supposed to arrive at 9 on the morning of February 11th, 1963 to help her take care of her kids. But when she arrived, she could not get in. She eventually was able to get in with the help of a workman from the building, and they found her dead. We found Sylvia Plath dead of carbon monoxide poisoning. She had her head in the oven. She sealed the rooms between her and her sleeping children with tape, towels, and cloths. So they're thinking that around 4:30 a.m. she put her head in the oven with the gas turned on, and she, like I said, in the early on, she was 30 years old. So if you have not seen the movie Sylvia with Gwyneth Paltrow and Daniel Craig, I feel like it's a really fair depiction, if maybe a bit simplistic, but a fair depiction of the final years of her life. And that was like super heavy, so we're gonna take a quick break and we'll be back shortly. Okay, we are back, and I would just like to say, as a quote from Sylvia Plath, "Out of the ash I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air." Now that's Josh's favorite Plath quote, and I have to say it's mine as well.
And you pretty much won me on her and you when you read me that poem.
I did. When we were first going out, I read him that poem.
We weren't even going out.
I guess we were just hanging out.
I was just trying to woo you with pizza, beer, and Gilmore Girls.
I guess we were just hanging out, but anyway. So, as far as Sylvia Plath goes and my relationship with her as a writer, I use her heavily as a source of inspiration for my own writing. I am a big fan of confessional poetry, and I try to write my feelings out, and it's worked out pretty well for me, I think. And it's becoming, I would say it's still not extremely popular as a form of poetry as far as literary poetry goes, but some people succeed really well at it, and I hope that I end up being one of those people one day.
I mean, I prefer it. Like, I don't like nature poems.
Well, I like some nature poems, but
there's nothing to think about. It's nature. Like,
but a lot of times there's usually more to it.
Yeah.
You gotta read into it.
But is it a nature poem then, if you gotta read into it? Is it really a nature poem?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, anyway, I would say, in my opinion, that Sylvia Plath is the second best American poet of all time. And I would say that the only poet, and Josh talks about he hates nature poems, but I would say that the only poet that's better than Sylvia would be Mary Oliver, who recently passed away, I believe. Actually, I'm going to look that up, because I feel like,
And I'll go ahead
unless
and
I dreamed it.
I can go ahead and reveal to our listeners, I have no idea who you're talking about.
Yes, she did pass away. But I had the privilege of seeing Miss Oliver speak at Salem College. She passed away last year. I knew that she had to, but I didn't think I dreamed it. But I think that Mary Oliver is the only one that's greater, and I adore her. And after we are done with this, I will read you a Mary Oliver poem,
well,
and
good.
You can tell me what you think.
That sounds good, because I don't even know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, the problem with the collected poems of Sylvia Plath is that Ted Hughes is the editor. And, well, first of all, she killed herself over him. Arguably. She obviously already had problems.
Yeah.
But he certainly didn't help. And, So my suggestion, if you want to read Sylvia Plath at her finest, is to pick up Ariel, her book of poetry, and that it's beautiful. It's perfect from beginning to end. I don't really know why Ted Hughes reorganized her work, and I don't know why he did it, other than maybe to protect his own reputation. I don't know why, but I don't think that he should have been involved in the editing of the book. I don't think that's right, especially since they were not together. And also because Ted Hughes is not nearly, or I should say, was not nearly the poet that Sylvia was at all, and most of his fame really is just from being associated with her. So I really think he milked that for all it was worth, and I just don't think that's right, personally. But anyway, I come back to Sylvia Plath's poems frequently. Often because when I'm having a hard time, which is more often than I'd like to admit, it makes me feel better to know that there's someone else out there that had felt the same way. I don't want to kill myself, but her poems bring me comfort. And I think that is important. So, I don't want to view myself as damaged, and I don't want other people to view me as damaged. But I do draw comfort from Sylvia Plath. And I don't think that people that like Sylvia Plath should be viewed as damaged either, but I think that we generally are. I remember one time I was at a family gathering. I was in high school and I was reading The Bell Jar, and my cousin Audrey walked in and basically asked me if I wanted to kill myself. And I was just like, no, I'm just reading a great book. But
I mean, you don't say the same when I'm sitting there listening to The Cure. It's the same thing.
Well, but The Cure is a little bit different, because here's the thing about The Cure. They write about, like, death and horrible things, but it's, like, wrapped in an allegory, and it's really about love. It's very, mm. it's a very, they're a very odd band. I love them, though.
Yes.
So, anyway, I like to read things that make me feel. And, Sylvia Plath, she makes me feel. She makes me feel things. And so that's why I keep going back to her again and again, because sometimes I just need that. I took my copy of the collected works with me recently, and I read every word of it in a day and underline my favorite parts and everything. And I'm sure that if I go through it again, I'll write notes in the margins. And I'm sure that my copy of that book will be in tattered remains by the time I'm an old woman. But it's just her work to me is just so wonderful. If you have the collected works and you're not reading Ariel or Colossus, I recommend just opening it up to a random page and just reading it, just reading a poem and just seeing what an immense talent she was and what a horrible loss it was to lose her at such a young age, because she had so much to offer the world with her work. She has something for me for everything, just anger or depression or sadness, or I mean, even that miscarriage poem that I read. There's something for everything that I have been through. It's there. And that's why I keep coming back to them, because there's always something there for me. I'll let Josh talk for a minute before I continue. He had something that he wanted to say, though.
Well, first, though, I do want to go ahead and say that I haven't read many poems, but I have read a few. You read some to me, and I have done the occasional, like you said, I just read the book every now and then, or, any poem book that we have over there, and just read something. And I have read The Bell Jar. I know that was one of the things I had to do before you would date me. And I really like that book, and I do highly recommend everyone reading it. It's short, easy read, but it's real. It's a real book. Like, it's one of the better books I have read. But it's a pretty sad book, and I like it, not because it's sad, but it's real. It's a real story being told. I don't know. That's what I like.
And I think Josh wants to talk about one of his most romantic gestures towards me.
Yes. So, I couldn't even tell you what year I did this. It's been so long.
I don't remember either.
I don't know. It was, I don't know.
Several years ago.
Yes. But for our anniversary, one of the numbers, I found this website or Facebook page that they would fold books. You have these big books, I'm sure you've seen them, where they fold hearts into the pages of a book or other designs, names, dates. Well, I had to find a book that was big enough for our anniversary date, which is 7/13/12, which means tomorrow. It's our anniversary
Our
date.
anniversary is tomorrow, and we both forgot, so we both had to order each other anniversary gifts today.
Yeah. Thanks,
My
COVID. Screwing everything
mom was the one
up.
that reminded us, because she sent me a text. What do you want for your anniversary? Oh, crap, that's tomorrow.
I'm so glad I'm not the only one that forgot.
Yeah, I forgot too this year, but we've
Yeah.
had so much going on, we've had so much stress.
Yeah. But I got her this book made. It has our anniversary date on it. But I couldn't find a Sylvia Plath book that was big enough for this. Except this book, American Isis, The Life and Art of Sylvia Plath by Carl Name.
Rawlison.
Okay, yeah, sure. But it's a nice little book. I mean, we have it sitting out. We have to keep moving it
So the kids or the cats don't get it?
Yeah, because it's folded. And it's like, it's not like it's taped together. It's folded pages. So I'm afraid to even attempt to play around with it because I know I'll screw it up.
Yeah, so we do keep it away from...
Yeah, hopefully when the kids are bigger, we can actually put it down somewhere.
I'm thinking of taking it to my desk at work.
That would be good.
Yeah.
Away from everything.
Yeah. If I ever go back to work, I mean, COVID is ruining everything.
Yeah.
But anyway, before we end the podcast, Ted Hughes did leave out one poem from this collection, and I feel it's an important poem. It's called Mad Girl's Love Song. And so I'm going to close this episode with a reading of the poem. Here we go. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I lift my lids and all is born again. I think I made you up inside my head. The stars go waltzing out in blue and red. An arbitrary blackness gallops in. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I dreamed that you bewitched me into bed and sung me moonstruck, kissed me quite insane. I think I made you up inside my head. God topples from the sky, hell's fires fade, exit seraphim and Satan's men. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I fancied you'd return the way you said, but I grow old and I forget your name. I think I made you up inside my head. I should have loved a thunderbird instead. At least when spring comes back, they roar back again. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I think I made you up inside my head. And with that, guys, good night.
Good night.